So I'm going to talk about some work on the M31 Halo that has been done on Keck and has and involves two groups, these people, and also collaboration with Scott Chapman and Rodrigo Abada, Nicholas Martin. Okay, so the motivation for this project was that the M31 Halo has been long known to be metal rich, yet have old globular clusters. In fact, as a graduate student at Caltech, one of the first things I did was to climb into the prime focus cage and guide for Jeremy Mold and Jerry Christian when they were doing the imaging of the M31 and M33 halos that would end up to be the landmark paper on the discovery of the metal-rich halo in M31, where 10 kiloparsecs away from the nucleus, instead of seeing metal poor stars, you saw a color magnitude diagram that looked a lot like 47 Tuck. So being that I was studying the galactic bulge at the time, I was very intrigued that somewhere in a halo there could be metal-rich stars, quite different from what we're familiar with in the galaxy. But another characteristic of the M31 halo is the presence of old stars. And it's very important to remember that the studies of the globular cluster population had very clearly established that at least there were a lot of clusters that have properties like those in the Milky Way, that have blue horizontal branches here. And to get a blue horizontal branch, of course, you have to be old enough for stars to end up with losing most of their envelope. And the models indicate that only happens when the clusters are older than 10 gigayears. And in fact, observationally, it's long been known that if you look at the small Magellanic Cloud, only when you get older than 10 gigayears do you see the development of blue horizontal branches. So although you can't see the turnoffs here, at least in these cases, you suspect they're quite old. The only globular cluster in M31 with a real age is G312. That was derived by Brown et al. That is about 10 gigayears old, although quite a bit uncertain. And it could be certainly 10 plus or minus 2 gigayears. When you make this plot for the clusters, which is the index of ratio of blue to red horizontal branch stars versus FD over H, a large number of M31 globular clusters fall on the galactic line, but some fall below, indicating that their horizontal branches are red for their metallicities and causing them to have the suspicion of being intermediate age. It's the ratio of, let's see, blue over red plus blue horizontal branch. Let me make sure I've got that right. Yes, blue divided by red plus blue. Now, what is red and blue? Well, if we take this as the horizontal branch, if we imagine the instability strip for our Lyrae's here, blue stars are over here, red are over there. So why is this interesting? Well, the second parameter effect in globular clusters is still unsolved, really, at some level. And that says that the strong primary correlation with metallicity is that metal-poor clusters have blue horizontal branches, and metal-rich clusters have red horizontal branches. But occasionally, some clusters break the rule, end up down here, and it's believed that maybe a small decrease in age is enough to do that. This is a sideline a bit from the meat of the talk, but I just thought I would give a little background. What is impressive here is that when you look at these two halo fields and you compare them to adjacent globular clusters, these were done with Hubble imaging. When you compare these fields here, you really see that the fields are just dramatically metal rich. So there is no question, even back in this early work of Bellazzini et al., we were very sure that the halo was quite metal rich. I said there is also my paper in 1996. It's just a very well established thing. The field population of M31, though, is rather complicated, and I'm sure that you know everybody has heard this now in talks from Raja and also from Nicholas Martin, that one of the great real sea changes in our perception of the local group, I think, was the discovery of the giant stream by Ibata in 2001, this feature here, which is not so easy to see, and subsequently Ferguson's map of the complex inner halo of M31 on scales of tens of kiloparsecs. So we went from this view in the mid-90s that there is a regular halo to this view that things are extremely complex. And of course, there's much of this meeting, this workshop period has undoubtedly been discussing accretion of satellites and so forth, but it's amazing how dramatically this view has changed. So there's a lot of motivations for wanting to survey the halo. Another thing that has changed is, along with the complexity in structure, has come the discovery of a complexity in age and abundance distribution. The jump from the perception of the halo is old and metal poor and roughly a simple stellar population in terms of its age has evolved from the Brown et al. Studies, which I've been involved in, of imaging fields along the minor axis of M31, marching out from 11 kiloparsecs out to 35 kiloparsecs, and also a field up in the outer disk and a field situated in the middle of Ibata's giant stream. What you see is, in all cases, there is an age range. And perhaps which has not been emphasized as strongly by other members of the collaboration, but I emphasize because I'm interested, is that when you do these solutions using the Starfish code to get these age metallicity plots, you always require the presence of suprasolar stars, or at least stars that are really quite metal rich, very metal rich compared to what you believe should be in the halo. And if you omit those stars, these fits don't work out very well.
And like, can you explain what are the sizes of the dots reflective of it? Are they density dots?
They are essentially, I've gone a long time with Tom Brown over this because I wish I could tell you that they represent population fractions and that they're nicely calibrated. And you can get tables from Tom if you're interested. He'll give you the tables of the fractional populations. These are heuristic guides to the eye to indicate what population fraction he's had to apply to fit this color magnitude diagram. And it's complicated because there's a whole grid of models, and you can get an equally good fit even if you omit a whole, if you omit this metallicity, this single metallicity here, everything will still fit fine. So it's very hard to assess kind of the goodness of fit how. In other words, take them as rough indication, that you have to have this much spread in age and metallicity. If you try to cheat one big chunk of this plot, you will not get a fit. If you ask how significant this fit is, and I have made the mistake of asking that, and you ask for tests as to how significant it is, you find that collaborators get very annoyed. So I stopped asking.
But you do have to have those 13-day-year-old supersolars.
I think you can get away without this, but you know the fit. This is the whole question I've asked. By the way, you say, no such things. There are no 13 gigahertz supersolar stars. Well, actually, There are certainly some 10-gigayear supersolar stars. There's in our galaxy. They're well known. These are these things with eccentric orbits that were studied by not Milan, but this guy at the University at Geneva. I'll remember the name, but the and then also Castro and myself, and then Barbie.
Are these things like orbit or color?
In the case of the solar neighborhood, they were kinematic and color selected through Michel. It wasn't Michel Mayor. I'll just have to remember that name, but. Through these surveys, Michel Grignon, who did the surveys. It was Grignon who initially did it. And then a lot of the follow-up work has been done by Barbwy. So these are basically, you know, there's a whole population of stars with Fe over H plus 0.5 and eccentric orbit and ages of 10 gigayears that are well established to exist. They cross through the solar neighborhood. Could be also that some subset of these are responsible for these microlens dwarfs that are very metal rich. There's some relation. It's hard to say, but they're definitely their abundances have been measured with a shell spectroscopy, and they're believed. Pompeii,
how bad is the age-metallicity relationship? The degeneracy for you? I mean, in this, can we? If we could take spectra of these stars, so some people have taken spectra for the stream.
Yeah, in fact, we
the same solution when you look at the.
Actually, I'm working on that quite intensively. What I would say, in fact, it's a work in progress. We're actually comparing these fits to our observations, and in some cases, they're reasonably in agreement. You know, within say half a dex or so, some cases surprisingly good. Sometimes they're off by about half a dex. It's not the problem too. Is one has to remember that here you're looking, you're getting these constraints primarily from the turnoff, whereas we're getting our metallicity constraints, as you'll see, from red giants, from bright red giants. And so there might be some issues with differences in how the sample is selected. As for how reliable these fits are, I commend you to look at the paper by Ferguson et al. 2006, the large one, and that does go through some discussion of how, you know, there are experiments done, and basically, I would say the qualitative aspects of these are correct. The differences are definitely correct. For example, the disk really seems to be lacking in older stars. But the details are probably not completely, you know, reproducible all the time. So another thing that has been discovered recently has been the presence of very large arc-like structures out at tens of kiloparsec distances. And also, if you plot the number counts of stars moving from M31 over to M33, you really see a point at around 100 kiloparsecs where there seems to be some, you know, drop off in counts and then a rise toward M33. So there seems to be some indication that the halos are overlapping. As you'll see later, I think there's other evidence that the halos are overlapping, that is kinematically. So. Okay. So some of the reasons that I've been interested in the problem of halos and halo populations also derives from a study that I did with Mustafa Mussin and Harry Ferguson and Tom Brown some years ago, where we took HST images of galaxies and derived photometric metallicities from the red giant branches, projected at roughly 10 kiloparsecs from the nucleus. And we found this interesting correlation between the total luminosity of the galaxy and the metallicity of this red giant branch, and some indication almost of a bimodality, so to speak. There's now a larger study called the GHOSTS study that will fill in this diagram better. But to me, this always was intriguing. since in hierarchical buildups, it seemed hard for me to understand why such a correlation should exist. The other thing that intrigued me about halos and caused me to be quite interested in M31 is the way this galaxy here, NGC 104, has a huge spheroid that's quite extended. So, you know, it occurred to me, is there kind of a bulgy class of halo where, in fact, the bulge formation has populated the halo with metal-rich stars? And maybe there is another class of galaxies that indeed is where the halo is populated by primarily debris. Oh, you have a question, sorry.
Where do you get the Milky Way?
Oh, well, that was originally, that probably needs some updating. I think that was from Chiba and Beers or something some years ago. This is a while. I don't know where people would tend to put it today.
That's a local measurement, right? It's a thing.
Yeah,
if you go out to 30, then you measure the metallicity of sand, and that would put it way up there.
Yeah, it depends where you, I think this could, of course, move around a bit, you know, depending on.
I think we have a really poor knowledge, off-stated comments. We have very poor knowledge of the metal-rich and the metallicity function of the Milky Way halo, because people have tended, like Ryan and Norris or whatever, tended to use, they just get worried about contamination from the thick disk and the thin disk. So they tend to not, sorry, below minus 1.5, they don't believe our middle is a distribution function, so higher than that, don't believe they were.
Oh, the good point. Actually, there are now larger samples of kinematically selected Milky Way halo stars, and I haven't been following this. I know the segue.
You're not going to solve it kinematically, so we're going, was saying, the ideal is to get out at 30 kiloparsecs. Imagine the darn thing at 30 kiloparsecs when you know you're in the halo. So that's what we're trying to do, using the brighter giants.
I see. So you're gonna find giants and then get select photometric distance selected giants.
We're gonna get spectra Okay. It's not an easy project because they're not all at the same distance. But that's our goal.
Why
can't you solve this kinematically?
Wasn't the Spaghetti project trying to do some of that, or
it's continuing to do. So if you believe absolutely that you could. Right, so the concern is, like Rosie was saying, that she was finding metal poor stars on disk orbits, and...
Let's say called the counter-thin stars, those are fairly cases now.
You were not finding enough of those, I don't think, so that was an interesting question about
But Spaghetti has measured giants. I mean, we don't have that many, but I think the mean metallicity is say minus 1.3, minus 1.4.
Right,
it's not that different from at out to 100 kPz.
And measuring K giants, you can't just measure the K giants, you've got to see if there's any M giants out there, of course.
Well, in the Beers couplet, there are like 500 counter-thin stars, of which we know the metal abundances were 20. It's an easy target. And the ocean is just going to measure them all. Those cannot be, thick disk stars. They're going around that way. So.
Right. That's a good point.
It seems like that would be a very good thing to do. So it would be very good to see what the Milky Way really is doing. And there is also the importance of putting more galaxies on this plot, which I don't know. Whether that's really going to happen anytime soon. So, I guess there is this ghost survey. So, one of the other things that had motivated this study is that there is a claim that the stream and the spheroid field have very similar populations. The horizontal branch and the luminosity and the red giant branch color of the brown field here was very similar to a field dominated by the stream that was roughly here. So there is this question, a growing question of whether the thing responsible for the stream, in fact, has polluted all of this is responsible for much of the stellar population here, and in fact might be responsible for a good portion of this structure as well. So that, you know, one big impact event could have been responsible. So the study that was done was to obtain Deimos multi-slit spectra over a range of distances, largely along the minor axis, a few of them off-axis, some of them quite close to M33, quite distant from M31, and in many cases overlapping these fields that were imaged by HST. And so the question is to look at whether there's an overall gradient what the dispersion and metallicity is, and whether there are streams within these fields, and so forth. At what is there a regular halo population? I should mention that there was an analysis of this data set done by Calarai et al., and they found a gradient. As you'll see, ours gets a different result, a steeper gradient. So here are some of the spectra. These lines here, these sodium lines, are gravity sensitive and they are found in dwarfs. They're very important in the separation of foreground Milky Way dwarfs from giants that are the targets of interest in the M31 halo. The calcium triplet here is the crucial set of lines that's used primarily both for radial velocity determination and for metallicity determination. Okay, when you separate the populations by dwarfs and giants, you get, which I'll talk about more in a second, you definitely do get a tendency for the more metal-poor stars to lie to the blue, the more metal-rich stars to lie to the red. We ultimately did not determine abundances using the calcium triplet for anything cooler than V minus I of 2, because at that point TIO bands start to overwhelm the calcium triplet and it's no longer giving a valid abundance. So here are the dwarfs. There are a number of blue stars that are dwarfs, and here are background galaxies, and these are the giant candidates.
I thought the calcium triplet was not calibrated for very high metallicity.
No, it isn't. Well, no, there is a calibration published up to solar. And beyond that, it's doubtful because of this issue of the TIO bands. But it is calibrated up to solar, I believe. And I don't have the reference. Andreas Koch, who did his thesis on the triplet, the first author on this work, and he could be able to answer about the details. But I didn't ask him about what we did. The flag that I did raise was this issue that for cool metal-rich stars, we had to stop, you know, because I was noticing that there was this problem in the bulge of the calcium triplet being overwhelmed by TIO. So we had to, we could not go on the most metal.
How did you select your targets? Did you just do like an even color distribution for things in the
regular? Color magnitude diagrams. There was a variety of ways. In the outer fields, they were selected by Majewski, where DDO-51 was used to reject foreground stars. In the inner fields, there was just a color magnitude diagram, red giant branch selection from CFHT imaging data. Then, in terms of separating dwarfs and giants, what one does is to construct a sort of a training set. And this was really first, the ideas were first originated by Gilbert et al. What we chose to do was to simplify this so that it was easier to do this kind of exercise for others working in the M31 subject area and just general population separation issues. So instead of having two-dimensional plots, we just use, say, the distribution of heliocentric velocity, the M31 giants here, the dwarfs here. You derive this training set, and then you can reject, you can use this with a likelihood weight to assign a probability just based on velocity alone of a star being a dwarf or a giant. The sodium doublet that I mentioned, dwarfs have a larger one, but there's a bit of overlap between the two. If you assign a likelihood based on this and you add things up, then, and again, color is another one of these separators. You can basically build up, you know, an argument for stars being highly likely giants and highly likely dwarfs. One of the things that we did in this study, though, was that all of these measurements involve errors. So we did large Monte Carlo simulations where we reclassified a star as being dwarf or giant based on its likelihood and imposing, you know, Gaussian dispersions of errors in the measurement of radial velocity, color, and sodium equivalent width. And therefore, we could actually classify stars as being 90% giants. And so that was, we stopped at 90% giants, though we could also look at two sigma and three sigma giants to make sure that what we were doing made sense and that our conclusions were safe. Here you can see the ratio of giants to dwarfs as a function of radius. Keep this in mind, as you get out to 100 kiloparsecs, there's a tiny fraction of giants in your observed sample. So any problems in this separation are a potential concern. But as you'll see, you know, we were able to show kinematically that we were quite confident. Another concern is the possibility that, you know how a lot of these indicators here, if you look carefully, I'm just going to go back here if I can. A lot of these indicators here work really nicely for the reddest stars. So, for example, the bigger the equivalent width of sodium D, sodium 8190, it's good for redder stars. You can separate out the dwarfs. Here, color, that's nice. Works nicely for redder stars. When you get into the bluer stars, it gets harder for these methods to be successful, and that's a concern. So the question is, what are the bluer stars? Well, the bluer stars are metal poor main sequence stars in the halo, and they can be simulated with the Besançon model. And in fact, Martin et al. Had looked at, you know, is there evidence for a departure from the Besançon model in these fields in front of M31? Did not find any evidence thereof. And what we found was that, you know, when you scale the numbers of stars and so forth, and you look at the velocity distribution, there could be some cases where you have counted a dwarf as an M31 giant. And it was incorrect, but it tended to be, you know, one star per field, where a field might have between 10 and 100 stars. So we felt very confident that having done this simulation, having looked at the actual numbers, here are the giants, here are the dwarfs, that we were, you know, that these are kind of rare stars, and still their velocities, you know, mostly concentrate toward zero. So I think this is not a problem, and if it were a problem, it would show up in the kinematics, which it hasn't. So Andreas developed this wonderful calcium triplet coaddition method, which basically takes horrible signal noise ratio data, like the signal noise ratio 4 data, and makes it possible to get some kind of measurement of the calcium triplet from those data. Here's his calibration. So this is the kind of the co-added calcium triplet as a function of V minus the V magnitude of the horizontal branch. What you see here are different globular clusters of different metallicities, high metallicity up here, low metallicity here. And here is a plot of the calibration. So basically, what we've done here is we've taken a very, very well-known, widely applied method, the calcium triplet method, and just modified it slightly to co-add the three lines together, and then construct a new calibration. So this has wide-ranging applications to all sorts of things, like, for example, giants in these newly discovered dwarf spheroidal galaxies. So it'd be interesting to see, for example, how this method stacks up against other new metallicity determination methods.
Did Andreas degrade those to similar ways before?
Oh yes, there was a huge, I won't show you the figure on the exploring how this, the reliability of this method varies as a function of signal to noise ratio, but if you're interested, please look at the paper. And if you have any questions, please contact Andreas. But we certainly asked the question of, okay, you know, this works for the globular clusters. Let's now see what happens when you degrade everything to the signal to noise ratio we're working with. The one kind of, I'd say, point of concern was that at the end of the day, the spectroscopic and photometric metallicities, these are dwarfs here and these are the giants. They did not agree as well as we would like. And part of the problem is that at the moment, at the time of this paper, there were two major sources of photometry. There were the Majewski and Ostheimer study, which we had inherited, as it were. And then there was this large CFHT survey, multiple fields with the CFHT. Still, you know, I would have liked to have seen a better agreement here. This is something that we agonized over, and finally, at the end of the day, I said, well, being a spectroscopist, you know, at heart, I'm going to believe the spectroscopic determinations. There are reasons why, you know, the photometry could lead to differences. If, in fact, we're in the wrong, we're actually getting greater abundances at this end than the photometry implies.
But like, it seems like the giants are basically okay. It's the dwarfs that are...
Oh, the dwarfs, you don't use the calcium triplet method. The dwarfs are just there to show that, you know,
really
the dwarfs are bad. Well, you know, I like to see, and this is like off the record here, you betcha. I would have liked to have seen a better agreement here between one thing that I did uncover was this issue with the metal rich end where we were, you know, so why are these red stars coming in metal poor? And then I started to look back at my bulge spectrum. They're coming in metal poor because TiO is overwhelming the calcium line. So we basically looked at, I guess, Garnovich's paper on 6791 and just decided the point where it was clear in NGC 6791 that the calcium triplet method just couldn't be used. So there are issues here about cool and metal-rich stars, but they're not important in the conclusions I'm going to discuss. It's just, you know, these are things, I tend to have very high standards for what I would like to see a perfect agreement, but, you know, it just isn't. So now I'm going to jump away to take a little bit of an interlude here on this Mori and Rich study. So I was very intrigued by the beautiful work of Fardal, who had modeled the collision of M31 and satellite. And there are many people who have worked in that group. I asked Fardal, I said, you know, I'm really worried, given that we see these age ranges in the HST data, are you sure that this collision has not ejected stars from the disk or the bulge? And Alvio Renzini raised the same question in numerous telecons of the group. And nobody could really answer the question for sure. And I said, well, okay, so what do you use for a disk? And Fardal said, well, you know, the satellite's an N-body and everything else is a static potential. And so Masao Mori was visiting UCLA. He actually tends to work on hydro codes, but he does like to do some N-body work. So I said, you know, I'm really bothered by this, that there hasn't been a simulation that really answers the question of whether this giant impact that made the stream could possibly eject disk or bulge stars into the halo. And nobody, you know, I've talked to people, they can't tell me, and Masao said, oh, I can easily do that simulation. We'll just use Fardal's orbit, since he seems to do a pretty good job reproducing the stream, but we'll put in a live disk and halo and bulge and see what happens and try varying the masses and see if, in fact, any stars are ejected from these populations. So here is what Massow adopted. Here are these parameters in solar masses. Satellite with a Plummer sphere, which actually may not be right. I think that the disk scenario that Fardal's recent work seems to, as you'll see later, may do a little better job of getting the shape of the stream. And he used Gadget 2, and please don't ask me how this is all done because I didn't do it. But notice that there are particles in the disk. And that, I wanted a real disk with stars. You know, kind of like, you know, that was the main thing. So in fact, he did this, and we got some other nice things for free. So when I saw this, I at least came up with the title, which is the Once and Future Andromeda Stream, because this is present day here, so you go back in time, and you also go forward in time, and what you get are interesting arc-like structures, which in fact, you know, are a plausible explanation for the observed arcs in the Ibata study. So that is that Ibata's arcs are a collision that was like this, a radial collision of a massive impactor, and we're observing that collision at a later time, 1 to 2 gigayears later, maybe. And there are other explanations for the tangential arcs as well. But I noticed this and it immediately struck me. This is like 50 kiloparsecs out. It was just about the right distance, and of course these are the things you see in the Hernquist. I mean, these things are nothing new. We all know this goes back to Hernquist and Quinn. What is new is that, you know, you get the reality by having the live disk bulge and halo. You have more issues of stellar interactions and damping. And one of the things I want to do is to just see what happens when you take away the live disk bulge halo and just use the static potential. One of the things that Gilbert has argued is that a possible cold population on the minor axis is actually a third shell. We don't get a third shell bounce in these simulations because I think the interactions of the satellite stars with the real stars and the bulge and the disk, you know, kind of destroy the coherence necessary to get such a well-preserved cold structure. You know, bouncing the ball through 3 or 4 times just doesn't quite work.
Like what fraction, you know, getting at this question of how many of the original sort of institute disk stars are ejected out?
Oh, I'll show you in a minute. I have a slide showing. The answer is, it seems pretty much zero. And in fact, there were people, there were some theorists who said, why did you bother to even do this? Because you could have, in fact, the first part of the paper is working out from, you know, dynamical friction arguments, what the conditions required to disrupt the disk would be. And it's just a pencil and paper calculation. That's kind of what Massow also told me. He said, you know, this has been thought about, you know, Toth and Ostreicher and so on. So, but we did get this. This is kind of nice. So this is this kind of comparison with this action going on over here. So, and what is this? Okay, these could be shells. I'll get to that at the very end. As things they're being studied now, and the spectroscopy isn't making the picture all that much more clear. Here's the nice new simulations with Fardal for the disk impactor, and you can see that in his simulations, you are getting something interesting there in terms of a tangential morphology. So. It'll be important to do large surveys and try to see if there's some abundance unity between here and here.
These are again with the static.
Yes. He. This is what's happening here. It's the impactor is a massive disk. But he is, it is offering another route to getting these tangential features. I'm very open, you know, as everybody knows, I do a ton of theory. Okay, so Masao is trying to put together a group to work on this problem, and we'll try to bring visitors to UCLA over the next year if this is approved, and look at different kinds of impactors and hopefully try to do something involving James Bullock's much more mature and developed effort at UC Irvine. And you know, this hopefully will inform a new set of observations. So here's the answer, Juna. So this is kind of the vertical thickening of the disk, this is no collision, 10 to the 9, 5 times 10 to the 9, and 10 to the 10. So you can actually get some interesting limits on the mass of the impactor, and it's somewhat consistent with the metallicity. I don't have the exact numbers, though. I'd have to look those up. But basically, there's not much issue with ejection, and the bulge, nothing. The other cool thing is that if you want to, you can actually look at objects that are in the depths of the potential well and ask where these things end up. And they end up in surprising places, kind of at the edge here, kind of over here. This is the real image of M31 with these shells, and then this is the projected image of the impact. So, for a while, it was kind of amusing because Masao was thinking, what if there were a central black hole? Where would that have ended up? And it would have ended up somewhere along here. And so he and Matt Malkin started hunting around for X-ray sources, and nothing turned up. But it was amusing that the simulations predicted this kind of thing. And as you get better, you can do more with that idea of trying to map the origin of the stars into their, especially if you really are able to model the collision really well, you may well be able to say where the stars that were deepest in the potential well end up. Here's the model, and here are some of the observations. So Gilbert was the first to kind of, unearth this triangular, structure. We find that as well. This is the simulation projected. Basically, it's just this morphology is largely just the projection of the shells. So here we plot the radial velocity versus minor axis distance. The top is kiloparsecs. The bottom is projected on the sky. The right hand is without the dwarfs. So the reason for the discreteness is because the fields of observation are discrete. These purple bars here are regions of deep HST imaging. So you can see that the inner field, 11 kiloparsecs, is very complicated in terms of its velocity structure. You'll also see later that it's quite metal rich relative to these other fields. These are heliocentric, yes.
What's Andromeda?
Andromeda is minus 300. In fact, right down here, sorry, this is so hard to read. This is minus 300, minus 200, minus 400. So what we've done, we had a referee who was a very concerned and caring referee. Actually, I don't need those, but anyway, we got one. And so they were really worried about our ability to separate dwarfs and giants. And so I said, what better way to ask if you're goofing this up than taking the things you think are dwarfs and the things you think are giants and just plotting straight along the mean radial velocity, okay? And if you're really goofing up, especially in the outer portions, you're going to start breaking down and having trouble. Well, these are stream positions here, so that's not a problem. That's the velocity of the stream. This is systemic M31. And this here is not a field that is contaminated by dwarfs, but we strongly believe that this is tending toward M33's radial velocity. So, you know, we feel that this plot here, remember that plot I told you where there was this huge variation in the number of dwarfs to giants as a function of distance? Okay, so look how stable the systemic is. And we're talking about more than an order of magnitude variation in the giant to dwarf ratio here. And it's just rock steady at that systemic.
Now, Mike, isn't that telling you, just getting back to the M33, M31, so sort of question, where does M31 tail end and M33 begin?
Yeah.
Is that the answer there?
Well, I think that Chapman Ibata offers an answer at about 100 kiloparsecs. You'll see, the answer is coming. So I'll get to the answer. There is a plot that actually will give you some indication of what's going on, and the answer is that, you know, it's like one is coming up, one is not disappearing entirely. They're overlapping. Okay, so.
Wasn't this already taken account when you selected dwarfs? Uh-huh. Made that assumption that for that velocity they should be Milky Way dwarfs.
This is true that in the dwarf training set there was a velocity-based assumption, but there was also a lot of weight on the other parameters, on color and sodium equivalent width. So yes, it could be viewed as somewhat of a circular argument, except that the number of dwarfs overwhelms the number of giants in the outer fields. Which means that if you've made an error, if your classification scheme is not working, you know, it's just going to be overwhelmed by numbers. The other thing is, keep in mind, we did these Monte Carlo simulations of the measured parameters to make sure that the classifications were really not based on observed, but rather that observed plus error parameters, which is actually quite different from which other works did not do, for example. So in other words, you don't ask, you know, today, is this star a giant? You take the measure parameters, you know the measurement errors, and you basically run Monte Carlo simulations. You ask, in this universe of Monte Carlo simulations, we would run 10,000 per star, you know, where did this star generally tend to end up? So we actually had a probability that arose from these. So yeah, it's true that this could be seen somewhat as a circular argument, and the only thing I can say is that there's a huge variation in dwarf to giant ratio. So the blue here, oh darn, I should have brought the plug. The blue here is the model, and the black is the observations, and the fit in kinematic space is absolutely horrible. This is what the smooth halo looks like. There are no kind of double horn profiles here. The only thing resembling something like that is here. There's maybe an echo of something there. So there needs to be better work done on the kinematics of the modeling, and there is also perhaps the suggestion that perhaps the stream is not a major, that the impactor is not responsible for the majority of the debris in these inner fields, or in these fields.
So your shells are just too strong.
Sorry?
So your shells are basically just too strong.
Well, the shells are strong. I think Ibata's, as you'll see in the next slide, I think Ibata's simple orbit model maybe, you know, I think we've got to go back and say, okay, let's take Ibata's simple orbit model because it does fit this, okay, and that. Okay, and then let's try Fardal's impactor parameters. Let's see what happens. Can we fit both the kinematics? Let's give up on trying to fit, let's not make the stream the major, fitting the stream's morphology, the major goal here. Let's try to also look at the kinematic data, which is now getting to be quite good. However, you have to worry. There are big chunks here, and if you look, there's a lot of complexity, both spatially and kinematically, and in metallicity as well. So the question here, I'm just saying, I don't think the stream is the main thing that's going on. Okay. So this is Ibata's simple orbit model. And see you here, minus 400, minus 500 or so. And then here in our data, these two clumps and, you know, same velocities. So, what we need to do is to take, there are good things in this. And when Masao just moved to Tsukuba and very busy now, but hopefully we'll look at this and maybe somebody else will first. It's all in the service of trying to, I mean, if you look at this and you just step away from the whole thing of what do I think it is, there is this cold thing here, there are these two things here which have to do with the stream. And then there's a lot of just, you know, widespread velocity, possible clumping.
What were those fields, the cold clump, where is
Oh, the cold clump is on the minor axis about 20 kiloparsecs out near a field that was imaged by HST. So here is our abundance gradient, and the arrow points to the inner abundance drop. Did I include switches? Roughly happening from here to here. So it's intriguing that, you know, we see something that is connected with some structure on the sky. Okay. Now, how significant is it? It's reasonably significant, but it's not rock solid.
Can you make this a little clearer? Because right now I just see the arrow pointing to a bunch of not many things.
Oh, no, what it is that that this is a drop. Look. Okay, I'll just do that.
You did the mean. Right. Okay, right. That's what.
And the mean, and somewhere there's, there's not enough data, but still, what you really got to notice is there's nothing. You know, suddenly all these guys have checked out, and they are measurable. They should be there. They're easy. See, they've checked out.
Okay, so you're complete to this upper right.
Yeah.
And swaths, and there's nothing there.
So these low metallicity guys are present everywhere. But these are gone outside that inner region. Obviously, one has to.
And if you did the mean of these stars, what is the difference between, say, 10 kpc and 100 kpc?
Just my recollection, between 10 and 100? You're dropping about a dex. You'll see. Here, I got this in a moment. I've got all that. The other thing we asked was, if we take a pure stream field in blue and we compare it with different places in the halo, are they similar? Not really, but again, not enough stars. But you know, I don't think there's like a hugely compelling argument that the stream is dominant. The other thing we did, again, for dwarf giant aficionados, who, you know, there was a real worry. There's just been a drumbeat that, you don't know how to separate dwarfs from giants. So what I did was a little amusement, which is I said, let's look at the TIO band at 7,100 angstroms. Let's plot against R. Let's look at dwarfs and let's look at giants. And what's amazing is how the TIO band is present all over the place, you know, in all these data. But you know, when you apply these discriminators, you're effectively out here just finding very few stars with strong TIO bands. And what this shows you is that the metallicity is dropping. You know, it's another way, independent of the calcium triplet, because some people have said, well, is the metallicity really dropping? So here are the results on the gradient. This is this is our work, and then this is the earlier work by Calarai, which was calibrated photometric abundances. Finally, Reitzel and Guhata Goethe here, David Reitzel's thesis, he did calcium triplet, and he was just, you know, he spent years agonizing because he said, I just don't know why I found such a low abundance. Everybody sees the halo of metal rich, halo of M31 as being metal rich. Here's Reitzel's work. And well, now we say, hey, David, you know, you're right on the money. as far as our calcium triplet study is concerned. So there is a discrepancy between the Calori work, which was done, which was based on a finely populated grid of giant branches, of model giant branches, and using the photometry and deriving abundances, and the spectroscopic method using the calcium triplet alone.
So how big a correction did you have to apply to your metals and distribution spectroscopy?
Well, we didn't apply any correction. We just did the calibration.
No,
we measured.
I meant so you photometrically selected your stars, but metal poor stars are not separated by a lot in color, and as you get to more metal rich stars, you get
In other words, the giant branches at the metal rich end, the giant branches disperse quite a bit.
Yes.
And you know, we actually have not made a plot of. Well, there was the plot that I showed earlier that showed the correlation between calcium triplet metallicity and photometric metallicity. And so there was quite a bit of a dispersion in the mean. Things tended to follow each other, except at the extremes. We were, the calcium triplet was a little higher in metallicity at the low metal. Okay. Restate your question.
You're asking, is the photometric selection biasing you against finding higher metallicity stars
or
to target
any bias?
So like you're complete at high metallicity, right?
I think it's easier to be complete at high metallicity. We did throw out of something like 3,000 stars, we threw out about 40 that, you know, had V minus I greater than 2. There is one little caveat that one has to worry about. These two samples, by the way, did pretty much use the same sample of stars, two different methods of analysis.
So that's just the difference.
That's just the difference in analysis. There is one potential gotcha, and that is that when you're selecting spectroscopic samples, you know, you are, of course, magnitude limited. So, you know, you can find an eraser. Oh, there's one. I hope I just haven't erased the solution to the economic crisis. Actually, that may happen on November 4th. But okay, so the problem is what, in fact, Jennifer was referring to, is that giant branches that are metal rich. This is Fe over H greater than solar, tend to descend because in the I band, TIO blankets, actually, believe it or not, the TIO molecule gets prominent enough to blanket sufficient flux at the 8,000 angstrom band. So these giant branches descend when they get metal rich. The problem is, of course, that when you're observing, you know, you have a sensible cutoff, which might be 22 in the case of M31. There is the risk that these stars just don't make the cut in the sample, and you could be incomplete at the metal-rich end. In fact, by the time, you know, one looks at...
That's greater than zero, and you're finding stuff, I mean, the discrepancy is at minus a half. So
yeah, I don't think we're suffering from this.
A little bit, but it's not
gonna... No, I'm just saying that these are... The real problem with these studies is that it is virtually impossible to model the selection satisfactorily to a point where you know anything much about number, densities, completeness, so forth. There had been work claiming, you know, smooth power law gradients in the halo from spectroscopic samples and the extent of the halo out to 165 kiloparsecs and so on. There are just too many selection effects to do this. The best, I feel, that in terms of mapping the extent of the halo of M31, the best hope has been these photometric studies by Ibata and Martin. Until you get much larger and much more complete spectroscopic samples, mapping the physical extent is probably done better by using photometric samples with large area imagers.
But here, Mike, beyond 50 kbc, is it correct or incorrect that you're actually using the same stars, you're just using spectra?
We're using the same stars, we're just using our method, calcium triplet method, and we've ditched the photometry. Yeah.
So Jennifer's concern and this concern about that is not...
These are really the same sets of stars, two different, pretty much, except the only difference. Yeah, the only difference would be
That's what I'm trying to get at.
The dwarf giant separation and.
I'm sorry. You don't have spectra for every star that there's photometry for.
That is not true, because these stars were all selected to be because they had spectra and radial velocities. Otherwise, they could not be classified as giants in M31.
Okay.
So, in fact, these are very similar samples, modulo possibly different dwarf giant separation issues. And, the two teams have not compared each star by star. It would be a good thing to do. One thing to point out here is this dispersion number, which does vary a bit from field to field. In the cases where the dispersion is varying, it's high. There is a suspicion of multiple populations and so on. Something that needs to be looked at. So there's a lot of things that need to be looked at, actually. So what we did was, being that we were finding a different result from this other study, we grouped our spectra by our metallicity, co-added them, and looked to see, as a sanity check, whether the lines actually were decreasing in strength as you decrease in our calcium triplet metallicity. And the answer is reassuring. In fact, these iron lines and titanium lines are steadily going away, so we are pretty confident that any other metallicity determination method that is thrown at this sample will pretty much agree with our findings. Look at what's happening in this panel here. Similarly, we did simulations with the Phoenix models, and you can see these iron lines indicated by the arrows. There they are, and as you drop down in metallicity, they're going away. Methods that use iron lines, large numbers of iron lines or statistical samples of the spectra, these new methods that Kirby has advanced, may run into trouble for very metal poor, low signal to noise ratio spectra. It may be very difficult to really get quantitative iron abundances for spectra of this low signal-to-noise ratio. However, if they do so, it'll be very interesting to see the answer. To answer your question about M33 and M31 halo overlap, these are three fields here at 87, 120, and 160 kiloparsecs. The bullets are at 160. This is heliocentric velocity and Fe over H calcium triplet. This is M31 and M33. So there you can see how overlapped they potentially are. And here are the velocity histograms. And this is the M33 radial velocity. And so as you move out, you see this tendency for things to move toward M33, and even in this field, you see a tendency of some things to be sitting at M33's radial velocity. When you look at this plot, it's easy to conclude, however, that things are pretty inseparable. Unless, for example, M33 stars were all alpha low and M31 stars were all alpha high or something, they're pretty inseparable, just as they are photometrically on the sky, just as that plot showed one halo dropping, the other one rising. So I think what the main thing to take away from this plot is that there might be a genuine M31 star out there. Where did that star come from, if it's out there? Look at these stars here that are somewhat metal-rich. And they're at very extreme velocities, and they're way far out. Well, they really shouldn't be bound, right, if they're that far out. But maybe they're the ejecta of ancient collisions, like the one Maury and I modeled, and an ancient radial collision of a massive impactor. That might be a way to get metal-rich stars very far out in the halo and keep them bound. Otherwise, you know, how are these things going to be bound? Anyway, there are new studies in progress by all the teams that are pushing on these 100 kiloparsec plus fields, and this kind of plot, you'll see a factor of 10 more stars in this kind of plot probably within the year. And probably not from my group since we only got one field done, but that's life, you know. Okay, so now Font has done some beautiful models of gradients here, and this is R in kiloparsecs and iron to hydrogen. This is alpha. Focus on the iron to hydrogen. Notice that they're really, you know, in these models, what I took away from this was that there are no large-scale regular gradients that Font's models produced. So, and she's in her office. Now, is she here? Oh, she's here. Good. Okay. Yeah, good. Sorry. Sorry about that. So tell me, what is, should I be worried, or what's the story?
Well, we only know like a dozen or so halos, and they were selected to be like Milky Ways. We have a major history like Milky Ways, so it's not impossible that you would get a gradient like in M31.
Yeah, is it a concern? I guess it's one galaxy, so you know. Yeah.
I would say that on like universally, you should not expect them to be emitting every single halo.
But this is amazing. In your models, there wasn't a single large-scale gradient.
But they were all chosen to be, you know, not have any action in the last many good years. So
that's one thing. But we see gradients on small scales, and these are averaged. These are beams.
Remind us about the models. These are just rigid halo things where you throw.
Yeah, they're rigid halos and you throw satellites. So they're made entirely from accretion satellites.
So you don't expect
so you don't have any. Yeah.
I mean, if you had a live halo, you throw things with a range of masses, I'm presuming a range of metallicities, then the ones that are more massive will sink further by dynamical friction before disruption.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
You will create a gradient. So you actually don't expect, given the nature of the modeling, to have strong gradients here.
Yeah,
I would
you don't.
Say.
Right. And another thing, these are.
Wait a minute. Hold on. You're saying that the more massive satellites will tend to sink through dynamical friction. Therefore, more massive equals more metal rich.
Right.
So naturally, over time, you would expect a gradient then. But
this is all being modeled here, so.
Oh, okay.
No, we didn't.
Nothing said it's not. They're not by halos.
But we do expect satellites, more massive satellites, to sink in the center faster.
You have that in there? You
can have it is.
So these are by halos.
They're not by halos, but we do have a prescription for the dynamical friction.
They are. Barely alive.
So the other thing is that this basically, taking this for a halo, spherical halo, and we average, so imagine like shells, and in given a shell, a given radius, we average all the stars in that shell. So basically, it's spherically averaged. Whereas what you do in M31, you shoot rays, and you basically can see more gradients along a single direction rather than if you would average, if you do an average of the entire M31 halo.
Oh, that's really interesting. Okay. Okay. Yeah. I mean, there is one of the things I'm discussing is to do a kind of a circlet at 100 kiloparsecs or something. Still, you know, if it's just amazing how regular this gradient is. I mean, it would be pretty bad luck. Okay, we're shooting rays, true. Still, it would be, you know, if you look at all of these fields here, I guess one could statistically sample, you know, halo models and just see how often this kind of...
I'm pretty sure cosmological simulations get great in the sky when we have a full Milky Way model.
So I would disagree
with Andrea,
I'm
not sure.
All right, so Mike, we'll send you his gradients and his calculations and see if we can get a match.
Yeah, and there's also, I also have to have a very close look. When Nicholas has his photometric methods, and when they do their final kind of closure of their photometric system, you know, they divide, Ibotta divides their imagery by metal abundance. The problem there is they're sensitive to the background field correction. So when you do a photometric study, you have to subtract the background field stellar population, which has its color magnitude diagram, from the observed color magnitude diagram. That's how you uncover the red giants. It's a statistical subtraction. The velocities are nice because, you know, the spectra are nice because your rejection of what's not M31 is superior. On the other hand, your numbers, you really crash in terms of numbers.
I don't know. The other point is, Typically you're looking at, I mean, you've got this thing that we used to call M33's halo.
Yeah.
Now sort of not calling it that. And then you've got this other thing that we're now calling M33's low Nicholson halo.
M31.
So is Andrea's model only really relevant for the like low Nicholson thing that we're now calling M31's halo? Is it not really relevant for this inner thing that we don't really know what it is and how it forms? Right? So by comparing the whole gradient, is this two populations that you're looking at and Andrea's only modeling one of those populations?
By the way, this I should mention, this one here is all radii and includes some off-axis fields. So this does suggest a somewhat regular thing.
This gradient is on the minor axis, right?
This is the minor axis only, and this includes some off-axis fields, but not many.
So the first few fields are spherical, what we call the...
These fields here, these are overlapping this, you know, complex region. So out to here, see this drop here? This is that drop I was referring to where it wasn't clear. So in the mean, you're dropping by roughly half a dex. Okay, out to here. Inward of that. Inward of that is this. And this is this whole, you know, very complex, I mean, this does not do it justice, but there's whorls and shells and, you know, streams and, so that inner part is that. But yet the disk is in way, way in there. What worries me about this subject area is that, you know, we figured out that pretty much there's a stream everywhere. In fact, And there is this large-scale regularity, it seems.
Isn't that comforting? Yeah. I don't understand.
Not if you want to.
I don't know. You know, I it's just that I say, well, okay, great. You know, we figured that everything is crossed by a stream now, and everything's a disrupted satellite, and so we pretty much solved the problem. I shouldn't start talking like this, because if there are any TAC members around, it'd be a disaster. Now, what we do, we do want to do a circlet of fields at 100 kiloparsecs. And so here's this stream C, one of these tangential streams. And gall darn it if this isn't broken up into two pieces. In fact, there are two velocity pieces for the giant stream as well. This is from the new work by Chapman et al. So what he's done is, what we've done is to look at various streams. I guess I should say, well, you know, I you know how they say I'm the candidate and I approve this message. I say I'm a co-author, and well, I thought this was maybe reaching a little too far. So, but you know, I wouldn't want to be quoted on that. You know, you have to. I've learned. You know, you have to be flexible with your collaborators, and it's one way of looking at these streams, which is to try to place them on this absolute magnitude. Plot and use the velocity dispersions to derive mass light ratios if they're bound, I guess what I'd say is there's definitely, you know, you need to have about 10 times as many stars in the streams to be able to do this kind of thing, and metallicities and so forth. So it's a way, you know, to go. I've always been intrigued by how the metal-rich and metal-poor stars divide out. There might be intermediate age stars. There's a lot of work to be done in this in the future. There's also these minor axis, these other work along the major axis, trying to study the pure halo population by Chapman et al. The overused, you know, analogy of feeling the elephant and trying to figure out, you know, the elephant from the tail and the trunk and so on. I'll just skip that. This is amusing. This is the distribution of redshifts of extragalactic objects that were accidentally in our fields. And there was a time when this would have been a substantial redshift survey. So one last little thing, actually, is this. And I'll just end with this, is that there's been this work by Carollo that suggests, in fact, that there is a difference in the inner and outer halo of the Milky Way with a drop in metallicity in the outer halo. Perhaps, in fact, we are seeing something like that in this study, a division between the inner and outer halo of M31. In fact, if one looks at it that way, one doesn't worry so much about the gradient, but about this metal-rich inner and metal-poor outer character. More galaxies need to be studied. Okay, that's enough.
Thank you, Dr. Kelly.
Any more questions?
What does Calorai say about this discrepancy?
I have proposed that the two, I feel that the best thing to do would be for the two teams to compare things star by star. What I do sense is that the Santa Cruz team is interested in applying Kirby's methodology to this data set. I think that, you know, they're leaning toward a spectroscopic analysis. I think that my feeling about it is that spectroscopy is one approach here. Both approaches are finding gradients. Both approaches are finding somewhat similar answers. We are finding a larger number of metal poor stars. This seems to be reflected in the coedition of the spectra and in the iron lines and so forth. We do understand that were we to use the photometric, the photometrically derived abundances, we would get an answer more similar to Calorie. And we don't quite understand that, and we don't believe it's due to failed dwarf-giant separation. So this is not a criticism of work. This is rather an indication that, you know, this is a case where, you know, you need to do more work, and it's an interesting thing to resolve. And when you resolve it, you'll get some interesting answers.